welcome you to tonight's lecture in the Mansfield series. And my name is Helena Kennedy and I'm the principal here at Mansfield College, and it's my great pleasure to welcome Rachel Holmes, our speaker tonight. Rachel Holmes is a really fabulous biographer. She's a cultural historian, and some of her biographies, I think, are some of the really fine biographies of the last few decades. And she's still but a girl. She's been described as one of the 50 British women to watch, and was part of a wonderful Arts Council Cultural Leadership Award programme. And she really deserved it, I felt, because what she's done for British literature, never mind the programming, for example, for the British Council, which I chaired at one time. She became really involved in the world of the arts and literature in a very, very profound way, and watching her has been quite awesome. The book that I've asked her to come and speak about tonight is her book about Eleanor Marx, and more of that in a minute. But she's been the author of a number of books, as I've said. The Hottentot Venus, if you can get hold of it and read it, wonderfully, wonderfully written, and about something that I have not known a lot about. She's also written The Secret Life of Dr. James Barry. She co-edited and persuaded me, against my will, to contribute to a book called 50 Shades of Feminism, just in case you thought it was something else. And she co-edited that. She was the co-commissioning editor of 66 books, 21st Century Writers Speak to the King James Bible. And she did that with two others. And she's currently the curator of the new Impossible Conversations, which take place at the Donmar Warehouse Theatre in London, and they're wonderful. But her book on Eleanor Marx is the one which I wanted her to speak about tonight. It was published by Bloomsbury last year. It was described by the Golden Pen Award winner Gillian Slovo as a dazzling account of a woman and her family, an age and a movement that grips from the first page to the last. It really is a phenomenal book, and a really important contribution to our understanding of women and history. Can I welcome Rachel Holmes tonight?
Helena, thank you for that very generous and warm welcome. It's a great pleasure and honour to be invited to speak in this series, and also by someone who has very much been an inspiration for me for a very, very long time. So thank you. I suppose one of the questions that biographers get asked is, why do you choose the subject that you choose, or how do you choose? You always want to have like a really erudite answer. But the fact is, they choose you. And that sounds a bit spooky, but they do. And there's always something that happens. There's a concatenation, there's a turning point, and somehow somebody comes into view that you weren't quite looking for. And I learned early on not to look, but to literally wait for the tap on the shoulder. I have to say, with Eleanor Marx, it was not a tap on the shoulder. It was kind of like a, you know, it was like this. It wasn't a heavy hand, but it was a very firm hand. And she came along, and I knew, and this is why I know this is true about biography, because for the first time, I had actually chosen a subject rather than the other way around, and I'd chosen Arthur Conan Doyle. And I wanted to do Doyle because I thought he needed a new biography, but I had some other sort of, I don't know, slightly mechanistic reasons, perhaps, some other reasons that I wanted to write about Doyle. And we were getting on very well. I mean, we had a good relationship. I'd been with him for about 18 months. It was, you know, we were beginning to... getting to know each other, and so on. And it really seemed to be going somewhere. And Eleanor Marx, an old friend who I had known for a very, very long time, but never thought about in that way, although she was a very good friend, suddenly came into view, and she came into view in a very particular moment. I grew up in apartheid South Africa during the bad old 1970s and 80s, and I cut my teeth in the anti-apartheid movement. That's the sort of history and the background and the politics that I come from. And Eleanor Marx is someone who is very well remembered in South Africa, as all the Marxes are. And one of the things that you find about her as a subject is that she's sort of geographically remembered in different places. So if you go to China or Cuba or you're in South Africa and somebody says, who are you writing about? And you say Eleanor Marx, it's like, oh yes, you know, what's new? Whereas the other parts of the world you go to and she's forgotten. Anyway, there I was and having a conversation on the state of post-apartheid South Africa. And in particular, what was happening some years after the democratic settlement, our first non-racial democracy in South Africa, and what was happening in terms of the position of feminism and women within the new South Africa. So there's a debate around the table with some old friends, and we start talking about Eleanor Marx. And an old friend and I say, oh, you know, let's run off and have a look and see what the new biographies are, because there must be some new stuff on her. And we go and have a look and cannot believe that there has not been a new biography of Eleanor Marx for 30 years. And the last standing one is the mighty two-volume edition that had been done by Yvonne Kapp, which is a very fine piece of work indeed. And my friend Jack looks at me and I'm like, No. I'm not going near, I'm not doing her, I'm not going near the Marxes, thank you very much indeed. So that's how Eleanor Marx happened. When I started working on her, I think it's worth mentioning, biographies take quite a long time, as a lot of serious projects do, but a lot of history or a lot of things have changed. And I little realised, or I little anticipated, that by the time I had eventually finished her and she was published last year, that after the impact of 2000, the crash of 2008, 2009, after the impact of the Arab Spring and the revolutions and youth revolutions, or youth-led revolutions, that were taking place in various different parts of the world, that Marx would be of interest again. That was Karl Marx in that case, and that there was a new rise in interest in returning to and reading his work, but also an interest in organizing and those sort of historical processes of what you do with a movement and what's required of that. And then Thomas Piketty came along last year with his volume of Capital, and every now and again they sat on each other's head in the bookshop windows. Obviously I preferred it when Eleanor was sitting on Piketty's head. But so that moment, it was very interesting to see how things had changed. But in seriousness, she feels a very modern character. She feels very much like us. And that was one of the things that appealed to me about her and still does. The other thing that should be said, just from a sort of historical and intellectual point of view, is that the Yvonne Kapp, there have been two previous scholarly informed biographies, in fact, the only biographies, the Yvonne Kapp was very, very good. But it was written before the end of the Cold War, and I was very interested to see what new materials there might be after the archives had been opened up. And both of my previous work that Helena referred to in working in subjects in South Africa, things change after political transitions, and I benefited from that in the South African context, but it was very interesting to see what happened once the Moscow archives had been opened up and exchanged all their work with the International Institute of Social History in Amsterdam, which is a wonderful archive. If any of you ever have an opportunity to go there, it really has the most extraordinary stuff. And it also still has this sort of 30 cents cups of the most sort of undrinkable coffee that are sort of poured out into polystyrene cups that everybody can sort of feel very worthy drinking in the canteen. But it seemed to me important to see what looking at this subject looked like after the Cold War and the loosening up of those archives. And another thing that should be said is that the Yvonne Kapp biography is marvellous, and it's a great piece of work, and I benefited from it hugely, but she was a dreadful old Stalinist. And, you know, and that perspective skews quite a lot of the readings. But I thought just to go a little further in, something by way of introduction before we get to know Eleanor a little more as a person. Eleanor Marx changed the world. In the process, she revolutionized herself. This is the story of how she did it. She seems an unfashionable subject, and then there's her father. Yet the public Eleanor Marx is one of British history's great heroes. The private Eleanor Marx was the favourite daughter of an unusual family. She was nicknamed Tussie to rhyme, her parents said, with pussy, not fussy. Cats she adored, fussy she wasn't. She loved Shakespeare, Ibsen, both the Shelleys, good poetry and bad puns. White was her favourite colour and champagne her idea of happiness. And yes, she was the first champagne socialist. It should be said, to be fair, that it was still called German sect at that time because the French hadn't said, you know, that it couldn't be otherwise, but nevertheless it sparkled. The life of Eleanor Marx was one of the most significant and interesting events in the evolution of social democracy in Victorian Britain. Not since Mary Wollstonecraft had any woman made such a profound, progressive contribution to English political thought and action. She left a colossal, although unacknowledged, legacy for future generations. Eleanor Marx was a revolutionary woman writer, a revolutionary woman, and a revolutionary. She was a person of words and action. Social democracy and radical thought were the family trade, not for profit, but for the progressive transformation of people's lives for the better. Eleanor's parents and the man she called her second father, Frederick Engels, were children of industrial capitalism. They grew into political adulthood in the revolutionary Europe of the 1840s, but their mature ideas were forged from the ashes of that early utopian and idealist socialism. The global triumph of capitalism was declared in the decades after 1848. Their child Eleanor, born in 1855, was heir to their ideas in a different modern age. Eleanor went into the world to put into practice and to test what she'd learned from Marx and Engels at the family hearth. Her quest to go ahead, to live it, soon took her into new worlds. The Shakespeare revival, the cultural realms of radical modern theatre, the contemporary novel, and the artistic circles of early Bohemian Bloomsbury. She loved steam trains and was an early and enthusiastic adopter of new technology, most notably the typewriter. She was a pioneer of Ibsenism in Britain. She translated Flaubert's Madame Bovary into English for the first time. And she took to the stage herself with sometimes hilariously misdirected results. She never noticed any boundaries between the personal and the political, even when she tripped over them and they sent her flying. What is it that we as socialists desire? Asked Eleanor Marx, and spent her life searching for answers to this question. From the time of Eleanor's childhood, the 1860s, socialism was the ideology primarily associated with the new democratic struggle against capitalism. There is no neat story of the origins and rise of socialism, qua socialism in Britain, because it was by character and intent a broad-based, diverse alliance of widespread radical thought and action. Tussie's life is one of the significant primary elements in the composition of the story of British socialism. And as Eric Hobsbawm said, you know, in the 1860s and 1870s, native socialists in Britain might have comfortably fit into a small hall, probably about this size. And Eleanor and her friends would have filled more than half of that hall. And what one of her really, you know, significant contributions was that she took what was effectively a literary movement and a textual movement at that time onto the streets and put it into practice, excuse me. And so who was she? Well, she was the youngest daughter of Karl Marx. She was born in 1855 in Dean Street in Soho. And at that time, the Marx family were poor, extremely poor. Later, when Engels was able to retire from filthy business, as he called it, but he was so very good at it, from Engels and Ehrman in Manchester, they were better off. But at that time, they were extremely poor. But nevertheless, there was no shortage ever of books and reading materials. So whilst they might have been at all times in hoc, you know, going backwards and forwards to the pawnbrokers, there was a great wealth of material, a great wealth of reading in the household. And in the first 9 years of Eleanor's life, that sort of 1855 to right, the first decade of her childhood, Marx was writing, was working on his great book, as she called it, Dada's great book, which was what became the first volume of Capital. Engels has said, just, you know, stop everybody having a go at you, and you can silence your critics and you can answer the questions. If you could just write a 30 to 50 page essay just sort of laying out your basic thoughts on historical materialism and your, you know, your sort of analysis of economic theory. And that proposition was actually what then became Capital in many volumes. So to say that Eleanor Marx was conceived out, you know, in the crux of historical materialism is actually a literal statement. It's not metaphorical. And what happened at that time was that she spent a lot of time as a child. She was homeschooled. And she spent a lot of time as a child sitting with Marx, playing around him, and as she got older, reading with him, and he would give her materials to read. We have a little insight into the family from those years, and it's a useful one because it reminds us that this was, of course, a family of political refugees and exiles. They were immigrants to Britain and considered potential terrorists and always under surveillance. And it is thanks to the surveillance reports that we have a very excellent picture, surveillance will do that for you, of what the inside of the Marx home at Dean Street was like. Toosey arrived into a family of political radicals under constant state surveillance. In 1850, a German newspaper editor calling himself Schmidt, they always come up with such unoriginal names, arrived in London, purportedly to visit the Great Exhibition. In fact, Schmidt was Agent Wilhelm Stieber, briefed by the Prussian Minister of the Interior to spy on Marx and his associates. Now, I should tell you that the Prussian Minister of the Interior at the time was one Ferdinand von Westphalen, who was Mrs. Jenny Marx's half-brother. So that is Eleanor's mother's half-brother. And he had been absolutely furious ever since he'd heard that Jenny was engaged to and then married Karl Marx. So it was an unfortunate concatenation of events from them. Stieber infiltrated German communist meetings and the homes of people connected with the worker and democratic movements, observing in detail the dwelling of its most prominent leader. So here we are in Dean Street. Marx lives in one of the worst and hence cheapest quarters of London. He has two rooms, the one with the view of the street being the drawing room, behind it the bedroom. There is not one piece of good solid furniture in the entire flat. Everything is broken, tattered, and torn. Finger-thick dust everywhere, and everything in the greatest disorder. A large, old-fashioned table covered with wax cloth stands in the middle of the drawing room. On it lie manuscripts, books, newspapers, and then the children's toys, bits and pieces from his wife's sewing basket. Next to it, a few teacups with broken rims, dirty spoons, knives, forks, candlesticks, inkpot glasses, Dutch clay pipes, tobacco ash, in a world, all kinds of trash, and everything on one table. A junk dealer would be ashamed of it. When you enter the Marx flat, your sight is dimmed by coal and tobacco smoke, so that you grope around at first as if you were in a cave, until your eyes get used to these fumes. Everything is dirty, everything covered with dust. It is dangerous to sit down. Here is a chair with only three legs. There the children play kitchen on another chair that happens to be whole. True, it is offered to the visitor, but the children's kitchen is not removed. If you sit on it, you risk a pair of trousers. But nothing of this embarrasses Marx or his wife in the least. You are received in the friendliest manner. are cordially offered a pipe, tobacco, and whatever else there is. A spirited conversation makes up for the domestic defects, and in the end, you become reconciled because of the company, finding it interesting, even original. This is the faithful portrait of the family life of the communist leader, Marx, at the time the most calumniated man in Europe. And I love that, because even Stieber, against his best, you know, doing his best job, cannot but help be drawn into the family. The writing of Capital is very, very important in Toosey's childhood, and later in her life, after Marx dies in 1883, she becomes key, because she becomes the editor and translator alongside, you know, with a team of people who bring Capital and the other volumes into print. And so she inherits that legacy. One of the things that happens to her as she grows up is that she becomes Marx's amanuensis. She becomes his secretary and starts deviling for him in the British Museum and effectively being his researcher. And that continues over time. So one of the central elements of her life is that she is an interpreter, a translator, literally a translator from German into English, but also a translator of Marx's handwriting, because she was one of the few people who could actually read it. And during the course of her life, she brings many of his works and essays and manuscripts that had not been published into publishable form. And in fact, in the last years of her life, extraordinarily, she finds what becomes value, price, and profit, and turns it into this extraordinary exposition. But what about her? She can't be educated, she can't go to school, because no girls go to school at that time. But she does have this extraordinary home education. She's effectively homeschooled. And I suppose if you are going to be born in a time where you are prescribed from going to school on the grounds of your gender, you may as well have Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels as to be your homeschoolers. And she got a combination. She got a combination of different types of learning and reading from them. But make no mistake, this was not only blue books, this was not only Hansa, this was not only trade union reports, this was not only historical analysis. Shakespeare was the Bible of the family. Her particular favourite was Richard III. She knew the speeches off by heart from a very young age. And she loved the Brothers Grimm. She loved Robinson Crusoe, and when she was 6 years old, Marx gave her Captain Marryat, and she was all for running off to sea, and then he gave her Fenimore Cooper, and she was all for going to America. But what happens is that also when Marx is off sort of looking for money from other members of the family, or indeed going to get various rescues and treatments, otherwise known as work avoidance behaviour to most writers, she would go and visit Uncle Angel, as he was known, Frederick Engels, and it is with Engels that she also has another extraordinary context of reading and learning that includes the Shahnameh. He gives her to read the lives of the Shahs. She reads one summer because Engels had a deep interest in Arabic literature, and also the poetic Edda. So this is the sort of range that she gets. She makes a break away from home at 16 to go and teach in Brighton. It's not terribly successful. But there is a very, very important break point in her life in 1871, which is when the Paris Commune happens. And she has a brother-in-law who is involved in the Paris Commune. And she and her sister travel under assumed names, bless them, thinking that everybody doesn't know who they are, but they travel under assumed names to Bordeaux to go and try and help out. And as a consequence of this, this is her blooding. This is the first time that she gets involved in any form of sort of direct political engagement, and indeed is arrested and detained and interrogated. And that period of the Paris Commune is extremely important to her, not the least because two things come out of it. First of all, she meets her first lover, who's an impossibly unlikely character, because he's everything the dashing communard should be, and deeply traumatised as well. Le Sagaret, Prosper, Hippolyte Lesagre, who wrote the history of the Paris Commune in tandem with her, and in fact they work on this for a long time. He's twice her age. This doesn't particularly seem to bother anybody. Marx admires him politically, but he's terribly worried that she's taking off with an impecunious political philosopher and radical. That book, The History of the Paris Commune, which she helps him write, is still to this day the key text that all books draw on for the near-hand account of the Paris Commune. But I think the other aspect that's very important is it's the first time that a really important theme of her career emerges, and that is of her nascent feminism. Because there are three key pillars of the life and the politics of Eleanor Marx, and one of those is internationalism. Her father founds the IWMA, the International Working Men's Association, in 1864 when she's a youngster. That's the beginning of the Socialist Internationals, which she is then involved in for the rest of her life. So her entry into organized politics, and particularly into trade unionism, comes through an internationalist perspective, not a nationalist perspective. The second pillar is her feminism, and the third pillar is her socialism. And the feminism really sparks off in many different ways, but I think we can see the Paris Commune as a key moment, because of course it is in the Paris Commune, critically, that women come to the fore and organise. And some have, I think, quite persuasively argued that, at least in the history of Western feminism, the Paris Commune is the moment at which women first start organising what is recognisably a feminist movement. And I think it's quite interesting when you look at the language of how condemned the Paris Commune is as a disastrous political event. I don't altogether agree with that. But it's very interesting to see how that whole history is quite determinedly gendered. That becomes a key kicking off point for her to engage in seeing women organise and meeting young other young women who are involved in the commune. And what happens over time combines both activism, organising, and her intellectual work, which is both political and cultural. Because on the one hand, Eleanor Marx gets involved in new trade unionism. She becomes the founder, alongside Will Thorne, of the Gas Workers Union, the biggest trade union and at the time the most successful. There are two big strikes that revive trade unionism, this new phase of it. And that one was the dock workers and one is the gas workers. And Will Thorne, as we know, goes on to become the first leader of the TUC, the Trade Unions Congress. And Eleanor is very involved in quietly and silently, and it's something that's not known about until after she dies, and Will Thorne writes about it. But she helps him with his reading and writing and literacy and accounting and oratory, and she did that for numbers of other people. And that emphasis on education is a really important aspect of how she organises and works. Marx, bless him, said that the workers would understand capital in their gut. I mean, there's a phrase where he says that. And I took the more sanguine view that a little bit of sort of helpful constructive education might unpack it more successfully. But this commitment to education at every level, and as an entry point to organising for men and for women, was absolutely central to her work. Her involvement in the trade union movement also combines with her point of view on feminism and on the role of women and women workers. And over again, she emphasises, as the men do that she's organising with, that this is a combined effort, and that women must enter into the union movement, because there is, in terms of the structure of how capital is working, in terms of the structure of pay, the dividing role, men, women and children, there is no way to make any kind of entry otherwise. But intellectually, it's worth pausing just to remember that That's the practical work. Those are the deeds. That's the marching on the streets, the organising enormous demonstrations. That literally brought the country to a standstill. The great dock workers' strike of 1889 was the first time that the river, the Thames of London, had been absolutely silent. And everybody joined in, even the rambunctious rivermen, who've never in 2,000 years joined in with anything. And there are these wonderful accounts, the city was terrified, and these wonderful accounts in newspapers of people almost talking as if London, the capital's been occupied. There's a sort of sense of something happening. But at the same time, she theorises what she does. And this takes us to this question of how the socialism comes together with the feminism. Marx, an egalitarian, like women, always a theoretical feminist, if you like, believing in the principle of equality, and actually sometimes goes a little bit the other way and says, says that he thinks sometimes women are better than men, which doesn't particularly matter. That's sometimes his view. But he never theorises sexual difference or gender inequality or the impact of economics in sexual difference in any of his work. Engels, as we know, famously sets his head to this in The Origins of Private Property, Family and the State, and wants to think about the impact of the sexual division of labour in terms of understanding how capitalism functions. And it's a fantastic, I still think it's like one of the great 19th century philosophical, economic, feminist texts. And where Engels gets to is, as we know, understanding the role of the sexual division of labour in, the reproduction of the means of production, which very basically means without the sexual division of labour, capitalism has literally no legs to stand on. And it's a wonderful, wonderful analysis, and Eleanor reads it while he is working on it and comments on it, because Engels does that project after Marx dies, but what he doesn't do is he doesn't come up with a program. So he theorises, but there's no program. And what we have with Eleanor Marx, sometime later in 1886, she writes this brilliant 20-page thesis, treatise, The Woman Question from a Socialist Point of View. It's co-authored with her partner at the time, Edward Aveling, although he quite cheerfully later says, I was off somewhere else, and I don't mind her putting my name on it. And that was all right between them. He was quite open on that. They did write some stuff together. But in The Woman Question, which she finds is an inadequate question, she brings together Marx's analysis of historical materialism and Engels's Origins of Private Property, Family and the State, and her own observations about the role of women and the importance of understanding where equality and social justice for all classes of people, including not just economic class, but seeing women as an economic class, and particularly working class women. And it's in that forging of a discipline of socialist feminism that I think that we can see quite clearly in intellectual history that she is the first person who does that. And in that essay, and I urge you to read it if you get a chance, she lays out very clearly a program of action. And one of the key points about that program goes back to something that I touched on at the beginning, which is the indivisible of the personal and the political. And that sounds like such an old saw, isn't it? It's like, that cliche. But the fact of the matter is that these realms were utterly indivisible for Eleanor Marx, because the politics and the economics and the structure of the home and relationships between men and women both personally and in terms of reproduction and work, were absolutely core to what was going on in the public sphere and in the economic environment. And that work, amongst all her others, I think really sums up one of those that key pillar of bringing together those different perspectives. And of course, she also brings to bear, really importantly, culture. Culture is at the heart of everything that she does. Her aspirations to become an actress soon fall foul of the fact that she realises that, having grown up sort of wanting to play all the, you know, the trouser-wearing roles, she finally gets a chance to go and do some theatrical training. And the first piece of work she gets is to go home with the Juliet speech. And she's like, you know, and by then she's in her mid-20s, and she's like, no, this is not really what I was expecting. And so it very quickly comes to her the realisation that she's not actually going to be able to play the roles that she wants to. The reason she's a bad actress is not only that the roles weren't there for her, it's because she was absolutely incapable of being anyone other than herself, which of course obviously means that you're completely missing the point if you want that to be your profession. But she was a brilliant orator. She was the most, in the 1880s and 1890s, she is the most in-demand orator around the country. She has a dizzying schedule, moving around the country, speaking at various different places. And by this time, she's known as our old Stoker, because she's the leader of the gas workers, or our mother. And I mention that because she's lost the Marx traces. So she's become this figure in her own right. But it's really important to reflect just for a moment on the fact that it's Eleanor Marx who, on her 31st birthday, introduces, if you like, Ibsen to Britain. And there's a new play by this playwright. She says that the Scandinavians are writing all this really amazing stuff. I don't know why is this happening? And she gets hold of this play called Nora, The Doll's House. And in her front room on the eve of her 31st birthday at 55 Great Russell Street, she does a staged reading, and she plays Nora, and Edward Aveling, her partner, is in it as well, as George Bernard Shaw is there, and Mae Morris, William Morris's daughter, is also part of the quartet, and indeed William Morris was there. And that play and the story, the metaphor and the analysis of that is in A Doll's House, and Nora is a figure, as well as Madame Bovary, the other work that's very central to her life, because she translates Flaubert's novel from the French into the English for the first time some 30 years after its publication, are key texts, and they're key figures of femininity that figure throughout her work. Those are just a couple of examples, but you will find them in The Woman Question. You will find them in other essays and speeches, that she's looking at these figures. And I suppose when we think about Nora and when we think about Emma Bovary, we don't necessarily think about, you know, they don't necessarily present as sort of successful role models. Or do they? I did an event last night at Jewish Book Week, and somebody said, Ellen Marx is such an inspirational person, and she was so amazing, and she was a trade unionist, and an activist, and a translator, and a leader, and she's this, and this, but she had so many failings in her personal life. She had a very, very complicated life. Let's just say she was a bad picker. And my response, and that's a question that comes up over and over again, and my response to that is that she is a very important inspirational figure precisely because of those failings and working through them. And it's no coincidence that Emma Bovary and Nora Helmer are figures and characters that, amongst other Ibsen characters, come through all the way. I'm going to go from there to 1890, to the first May Day ever celebrations Because that takes us... excuse me. It takes us to a point of looking at that, the third part, which is the internationalism, which is so absolutely crucial to Ellen Marx's thinking and activism, and so relevant to us now, as I would argue many other aspects of her career were and are. And she was very concerned at the prevalence of Christianity and Protestantism within the British trade union movement. Not that it existed, but that as she got more and more involved, she began to see, well, let's say there's more Methodism than Marxism in British socialism, but where she began to identify not only problems of sexism and gender difference, but also forms of xenophobia and racism. And one of the things that's absolutely critical to her developing thinking is when she begins to understand the difficulties that Jewish workers are having and with organising and with presenting and operating within the trade unions, and she is able to get involved and help in many ways with that. And as she did throughout her life, she was multilingual. She spoke French and German at home and English. She'd learnt many languages. She learnt Norwegian so she could better understand Ibsen. But she learnt Yiddish as well, and she started to speak in quite haltingly at first, but then got better and more fluent. But come 1890 is this turning point, and what's happened throughout the 1880s is that Ellen Marx has been, from 1880 to 1890, she's very, very involved in setting up the SDF, the Social Democratic Federation, and then the Socialist League, which is the breakaway. She and William Morris break away from the SDF and found the Socialist League, which then in time becomes the foundation of what becomes the Independent Labour Party. So she becomes very, very involved. So those twin things are going on, organising with trade unionism, but also organising in founding what becomes the first political party to represent Labour in Britain. At the International, prior to May Day, Eleanor was the person who put forward the resolution for an international day of workers to down tools and to be recognised internationally. Not as a holiday for beer and sandwiches and dancing around, although frankly why should it not be, but actually as an organisation point for the 8-hour day, because that 8-hour day movement critically is something that she spent a very, very long part of her career involved in. And I think as we sit here looking at a situation of 0-hours contracts and the erosion of those principles of labour and the organisation of justice in a working environment, it's not irrelevant. She puts forward that motion and it is passed, and then in May 1890 there is the first May Day rally in Hyde Park, and alongside others Eleanor makes a speech that encompasses, I think, some of the elements that I briefly tried to draw out this afternoon. Her determined socialist internationalism, her commitment to British trade unionism, and the need for a parliamentary Labour Party to represent working people. And I think that perhaps a place to end would be to hear some words from Eleanor, and this is part of the speech. We have not come to do the work of political parties, but we have come here in the cause of labour, in its own defence, to demand its own rights. I can remember when we came in handfuls of a few dozen to Hyde Park to demand the 8 hours bill. But the dozens have grown to hundreds, and the hundreds to thousands, until we have this magnificent demonstration. Those of us who have gone through all the worry of the dock strike, and especially the gas workers' strike, and seen the men, women and children stand round us, have had enough of strikes. And we are determined to secure an 8 hours day by legal enactment. Unless we do so, it will be taken from us at the first opportunity. We will only have ourselves to blame if we do not achieve the victory which this great day could so easily give us. I am speaking this afternoon not only as a trade unionist, but as a socialist. Socialists believe that the 8 hours day is the first and most immediate step to be taken. And we aim at a time when there will no longer be one class supporting two others, but the unemployed both at the top and the bottom of society will be got rid of. This is not the end, but only the beginning of the struggle. It is not enough to come here to demonstrate in favour of an 8 hours day. We must not be like some Christians who sin for 6 days and go to church on the seventh, but we must speak for the cause daily and make the men, and especially the women that we meet, come into the ranks to help us. And at this concluding point, Eleanor paused and then she rolled out Shelley's great thunderous invocation to working class Englishmen and women in the mask of anarchy. Rise like lions after slumber, in unvanquishable number. Shake to earth, shake your chains to earth like dew, which in sleep had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few.
Well done.